if there's a, you know, suppressed turnout scenario in New York City, we could see a result or, you know, or a kind of level of competitiveness in the two parties that's closer to, you know, Governor Hochul's narrow-ish win, I guess, on, you know, New York historical standards over Lee Zeldin from 2022.
Hi there, it's WAMC News Director Ian Pickus, and on this episode of the WAMC News Podcast, the Republican message from Milwaukee. Republicans are united behind former President Donald Trump as he looks for a second term. That was the message of the Republican National Convention, which came just after Trump narrowly survived an assassination attempt.
If I had not moved my head at that very last instant, the assassin's bullet would have perfectly hit its mark, and I would not be here tonight. We would not be together.
But the national unity Trump pledged to focus on was a fleeting part of a record 93-minute acceptance address. Jake LaHut is covering the campaign for the Daily Beast and is just back from Milwaukee. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me back, Ian. Good to be here.
So what kind of message did you hear from former President Trump? Obviously, it was his highest profile remarks since the shooting in Pennsylvania a few days earlier.
Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, in typical Trump rally fashion, it seemed like the ratio of prepared remarks to riffs was maybe 50-50 or a third prepared and two-thirds unprepared. I was in the hall for most of that night. And then I watched the speech from this really popular bar with a lot of the Trump people that was just outside the kind of fence perimeter the Secret Service set up there. I mean, he had a number of, like, things came to mind, especially when he was talking about, you know, the Democrats. I believe he said something along the lines of weaponizing COVID. But, you know, lines like that were not in the prepared remarks, and there were reporters in the hall who had a view of the rolling teleprompters, and you could tell when it stopped, and he was just going off on his own. The other notable thing was that the Trump campaign tried to signpost that he wasn't going to mention Biden's name at all in the speech, and that didn't happen either. So, you know, I mean, I think a lot of it was, you know, Trump was dying to get back out there. The crowd was seemed even more eager to hear from him. And, you know, I think that, like, when you're in your late 70s, it is kind of hard to have, like, a complete switch over in your personality. Now, I don't doubt that. I mean, this was an extremely traumatic incident for him and his family. And, you know, I talked to some of the reporters who were there at the Pennsylvania rally. And, you know, the press tent at Trump rallies is also just, it's the most fish in a barrel part of the whole thing. So, you know, I think everyone came in thinking that, you know, it could be this pretty sober tone from him. And I think as we've seen a number of times before, both in the Trump presidency and going back to the 2016 campaign, he has these very fleeting moments of trying to, you know, have a more, you know, even-keeled, sort of sober-minded approach to his rhetoric. And then he kind of reverts to his default setting. It wasn't, you know, the kind of fire and brimstone seen before, but I think the speech ended up sort of being about, you know, half normal Trump rally, and then he tried to kind of shoehorn in the unity stuff. And I also think that, you know, I was talking to Laura Loomer, who is a, you know, a right-wing gonzo-style journalist who almost got a job with the Trump campaign, but for her past remarks that have been, fair to say, quite bigoted about, you know, in the realm of Islamophobia and a bunch of other areas. But she speaks to Trump frequently. And I talked to her after J.D. Vance's speech, and she made a point that, you know, the kind of crowd of people who come to a convention, you know, they typically want to hear a lot of red meat. They want to hear attack lines. But this time around, because of the assassination attempts, you know, there certainly was, I think, a very real appetite among that crowd to want to hear some of the unifying messaging, but, like, you know, the same kind of attack lines of the Democratic Party were definitely going to be hit no matter what.
So the convention is obviously, you know, it's geared toward a TV audience. It is a political event, but to the extent that you heard a lot of speeches over those days, what kinds of policies are Republicans proposing should Trump win back the White House?
Well, I think, you know, one notable thing was that the J.D. Vance speech, and I believe Trump's speech also, didn't really mention abortion at all. That was completely downplayed across almost all of these speeches. There were a number of speakers who had a similar experience of having some sort of, you know, violent crime happen or attack happen to a member of their family or themselves that was, you know, blamed on immigration. I mean, there was talk about inflation and a little about the tariffs. Obviously, no connection to the fact that if Trump were to, you know, regain office and impose these 10% tariffs or, you know, upwards of 30% or more on Chinese goods, that would be extremely inflationary based on the consensus of economists. But, you know, I mean, like the way he's transformed the party, it was much more vibes-based. I mean, you weren't hearing a lot of kind of concrete plans. The other thing I thought was notable outside of the speeches was the presence of the Heritage Foundation there, because I mean, the Biden campaign's big message as the convention approached was trying to bang the drum of that think tank's Project 2025. So one thing that I thought was kind of interesting was I went up to their booth that was in one of the nearby convention halls that wasn't the main arena, and there was no mention of the thing at all in all this merch and swag they were selling. So, you know, I mean, I think the common thread among the speeches was that this is a party that is very confident they're going to win. And in some ways, especially the higher profile speeches like Vance's, to a certain extent Trump's, they kind of reflected almost a more defensive approach. I think it was Sam Stein from The Bulwark who described Vance's speech as the cover two defense of vice presidential nomination speeches. And for those of you who don't know football, that's like, you know, kind of like a middle of the road, like pretty basic formation where you're trying to make sure that no one can, you know, put up too many yards on you. And I think that was the overall goal, was to try to just keep underscoring this notion that the Republican Party is totally unified behind Trump. But when it comes to, you know, the economic and foreign policy side of it, I think aside from, you know, the NATO bashing, you know, the desire to not support Ukraine further, and then on the economic side, you know, a little bit of mention of these tariffs, a lot of talk about inflation, but not necessarily about, like, rate cuts at the Fed or stimulus spending. But, you know, it just there weren't a whole lot of specifics on those fronts. I mean, to a certain extent, that's not surprising for a convention, but I think that if you look at the Vance speech, one of the recurring themes you kept hearing at the convention was this, and I'm paraphrasing here, but essentially an assertion that America isn't just an idea, but it's a nation. And what Vance means by that is that, you know, this is not about kind of democratic norms or values, that America is about the physical borders of the country and the shared history of the people who have been here. So, you know, there are a lot of kind of boilerplate lines of, like, you know, we're in favor of immigration, but it's got to be on our terms. You know, we can't mess up our shared history too much. And this is much more along the lines of kind of the global, you know, far-right nationalist populist movements that have been sprouting up in a bunch of Western democracies, and, you know, all of which have, when you look at the polling and the voter exit poll breakdowns of these movements, tend to split very heavily between, you know, college and non-college educated lines. And I think that was a big focus, was despite the, you know, there's this, a lot of talk from the Trump campaign about, and, you know, they had a rap video, a whole bunch of attempts to try to attract voters of color, but ultimately, if you look at, like, who got the big primetime slots, I think that, you know, clearly the demographic they want to run up the score the most with is, you know, younger non-college educated men who probably otherwise wouldn't show up to vote. And I think that's why it was not surprising to see on the final night that the two big speakers before Trump were Hulk Hogan and then Dana White, the head of the UFC, who, by the way, has a connection to one of Trump's top staffers, Stephen Chung, who had been doing communications for that Ultimate Fighting League before coming back into Republican politics.
So you mentioned that, you know, Trump and Vance are now in place. One person who had been considered at one time for the vice presidential pick was Northern New York Congresswoman Elise Stefanik, who was vetted for the role, according to reporting. So what did she have to say? I did note that she pledged that New York would go for Trump in this election.
Yeah, and well, I mean, I certainly think that on the House side, that's where a lot of this is going to come down to in terms of the majority and whether the Democrats can flip that and take it back. I also think that, you know, based on the polling that both Democrats and Republicans are looking at here, I mean, the race has tightened in New York. And, you know, it's not hard to imagine that if there is a, you know, suppressed turnout scenario in New York City, we could see a result or, you know, or a kind of level of competitiveness to the two parties that's closer to, you know, Governor Hochul's narrow-ish win, I guess, on, you know, New York historical standards over Lee Zeldin from 2022. You know, funnily enough, I was watching the Stefanik speech, I kept looking out for like, okay, like where are her unity lines going to be? Because kind of in the back of my mind the whole time, you know, sort of from a trying to put my speechwriter hat on, looking at like how they were transitioning to these lines. A lot of the additions of unity to the remarks here seemed very forced. And then I think the best example of how like this didn't always go well was Ron Johnson, like just gave the wrong speech apparently. But you know, the only reference to unity Stefanik made was that how she claimed she had unified House Republicans. And there really wasn't a whole lot of demonstrated interest from her in the speech about bringing together Americans of, you know, all parties or folks who are less political. And, you know, she still seemed to be in that kind of attack dog role that was part of her appeal as VP. I think the question is, you know, whether she will be in contention for a major cabinet position or if she will kind of continue to be this, you know, basically she's become the New York Republican Party. And that, you know, in a seat as safe as hers, you know, this could be the kind of position she'll have where, you know, these more competitive districts in the Hudson Valley and Long Island are kind of have become her fiefdom, even though her district is like the furthest away north from all of those, you know.
So just to wrap up here, you know, I was struck watching from afar how much Trump had turned around his standing. You know, if I think back to 2020, he lost the election. In the waning days of his presidency, he was impeached for inspiring the January 6th attack on the Capitol. And he was probably at as low an ebb as a president can be. And yet, during this convention, you know, his rivals in this primary campaign were all there to endorse him wholeheartedly. So, I mean, it's we'll see what happens in November, but I think kind of a remarkable comeback.
Oh, I mean, I think it could be viewed as maybe the greatest comeback in American political history. There are two things that stood out to me on that front. One was when I was at this bar as a bunch of, you know, kind of MAGA celebrities and other Trump staffers and hangers-on started pouring in after the speech. I had one very high-ranking GOP strategist tell me, and this person got more and more confident in their assessment as they took more sips of this martini.
That'll happen.
They definitely can. And this person said that they think after the assassination attempt that Trump has become the most important political figure in the U.S. since the Civil War, and that especially his response to it and the kind of the sort of literal iconography and the imagery that came from it of the fist pumps and all that sort of, you know, locked up the a lesson for him. But the other one that I thought was kind of notable was Minnesota Governor Tim Walz was holding this event for the Biden campaign. I think it was on Wednesday. And he described the, you know, the Nikki Haley and Ron DeSantis night of the convention as the grovel and bend the knee theme of the day. And, you know, it really was a demonstration of how, even though there was a ton of money spent against Trump in this primary, and it did get very heated at times, you know, he demonstrated that he still has an incredible amount of control over the party. And, you know, I think that what's fundamentally changed is you know, the way people maybe have understood this before from 2016 to 2020 was that he had a captive hold on, you know, maybe two-thirds of the Republican Party or something like that, and that his, you know, support nationwide was maybe 30 to 40% of Americans. I mean, it's pretty clear that because of a couple of factors, you know, one being a bit of a memory holding of the pandemic, I think because that was such a tumultuous and traumatic time for people, people don't like talking about it, they don't like remembering it. And, you know, there is a certain kind of rose, you know, tinted glasses dynamic when it comes to looking back at his presidency. And the other, I think, is the crucial period of what happened between January 6th in 2021 and the 2022 midterms, where a lot of people wrote him off. And I think that one thing that the Trump campaign and his, if you want to call it Trump World 3.0, has been very effective at doing is basically channeling his energy and messaging in a way that, you know, frankly, people who the staff he has churned through before have been unable to do. I think a key component of this is that they kept him off of Twitter. Even when Elon Musk, you know, offered to reinstate him, he didn't rejoin. Now, they have the sort of financial incentive there to, you know, tell him, like, look, like you have been social, and, you know, if you start posting on Twitter instead of Truth Social, that sort of inherently cheapens, you know, the value of this platform that you've launched. But I think, you know, the other, you know, more important aspect of that on a de facto level is that even though he has the same kind of, you know, fire and brimstone or unhinged remarks on Truth Social, and even though there are reporters who will share screenshots of those on, you know, more mainstream social media sites, they simply don't penetrate the news cycle or the kind of popular psyche the way that the tweets did. And, you know, I mean, how many times can you remember from the Trump presidency of, you know, a Republican of some degree or another saying, you know, love the guy, love his policies, but, like, really hate the tweets? And their ability to really crack down on that and also keep him disciplined through the criminal proceedings, where they were able to use this as pretty much a, you know, pure upside fundraising opportunity. You know, having him go to court when he didn't have to before the Manhattan trial, and being able to use those to really galvanize the base and then eventually just supercharge the fundraising, I think that's been probably the most effective, you know, 1-2 punch of the Trump campaign strategy so far. And I think, you know, it's hard. Obviously, we can't do a double blind test against an alternate scenario here, but I would venture to say that if he were still on Twitter and, you know, behaving the way he did in the 2016 campaign and then during his presidency, you know, I think that a lot of these voters who have kind of swung back to Trump or become Trump curious would not be as interested in it. And then, you know, there's also just his image in the popular consciousness as a good businessman. And, you know, because of the way the economy is so contradictory and weird right now, with, on the one hand, you know, the U.S.'s broad macroeconomic numbers are great and much better than our, you know, peer developed nations, you know, the persistent cost of housing, groceries, all those things, you know, there just isn't a sense, this is borne out in the polling, that, you know, voters, not just of the Republican Party, but independents as well, trust him much, much more on the economy. And, you know, the Trump campaign, I mean, Chris Placevita, the co-campaign manager, has basically said, like, you know, this, they still think that the fundamentals of this race are about the economy and immigration. But I think what the assassination attempt did was also provide Trump an opportunity to soften his image, you know, generate sympathy. And frankly, when it comes to, you know, not just the base, but, you know, the broader Republican Party and those Trump curious voters, it really does reinforce for him the sense that he's been, you know, persecuted. People are coming after him. And even though we still don't know that much about the shooter and his motives, you know, we do know that the shooter looked into, you know, Joe Biden's whereabouts. And it that's kind of it, though. But it doesn't matter for them. I mean, the mentions of the assassination attempt at the convention were all about, you know, they have tried to take him out, yada, yada. They meaning, you know, the Democrats, the left, the quote-unquote mainstream media, all that. And, you know, it's been kind of the perfect storm of events where he's had probably the best, you know, 5 to 6 weeks of his entire political career up until this point.
Jake LaHut is covering campaign 2024 for The Daily Beast, and we've been speaking about the Republican National Convention in Milwaukee. Jake, so grateful for your time and reporting, and if it's okay with you, we'll catch up in Chicago.
Yeah, sounds good. I will be there.
Okay, that does it for this episode of the WAMC News Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. Until next time, I'm Ian Pickus.